Dale's making his way down there, we're kind of shifting gears here from the big picture, some of the broad studies and work that's going on down to, okay, what's in it for us? So we're looking for South Dakota's role now in this developing wind resource.
Okay, I'll do it from the old one. Add some nice new slides for you, but we can't show them to you, so they're a secret. They'll be online later. Midwest ISO does only one thing, that's transmission. We don't do the market matchups between generation and the loads. Once it's all matched up and ready to go, we deliver it. That's our job. And I'd also like to say that one of the things that to identify your market, which if you don't have any in South Dakota, you'd like to know where it is. The study that was just discussed identifies that. And if you want to know what the entire market is, have your congressional delegation support funding for NREL to give us the rest of the wind information for the rest of the East Coast. The reason that we have that much is that's how much money they had, so that's what we get. So if your market's too small and you don't know about it, it's your own fault. Next slide. Oh, I am. Okay. You want a bat? That's the new one. MISO has two study processes. One is the joint study that we just talked about, which is MISO and all its neighbors. And the other one is MISO alone. And when you get into the interconnection processes and all of that, that's MISO alone. But we bring all that up to the top and we match those two studies together. So all the information from one is in the other and vice versa. What's important about these studies? This is where you get your information to build your business cases, to build your transmission, your generation systems. These are economic models of the entire eastern United States. We have the revenue to wind generators, we have the energy you'll produce, we have the curtailments that'll be produced on wind generation in areas. We have the capacity factor of coal plants, and we have the costs. We have transmission estimates, and that all that information is what comes out of here. And MISO operates under a premise of being fair and transparent. Fair means everybody gets treated equally bad, and transparent means that everybody knows your business at the same time you do, so you don't have any secrets. So we are fair and transparent. And our processes are quite open, and people participate in them. And they're advertised, and the results are publicly put out there. And there's a lot of information on our websites. But that's what these plans are for. They give you information. Now, where is MISO? MISO's this stuff in the blue. Manitoba's a coordinating member. And it, some people say it looks like Swiss cheese, but we just think it's nice. It's us. And then the rest of the orange there, they're a little bit, there might be chocolate chip cookies, I don't know. That's the PJM system. The MISO system and the PJM system, if you get into that market, you can go everywhere with one transmission charge. It's like get on and you get your mail delivered. If you go across any one of those seams or the color changes, you pay additional transmission charges. If you're outside that seam and you want to get to MISO, you have to pay to get to MISO, and then you got to get pay through MISO. So that's what they call pancaking. In MISO and PJM, there's no pancaking. Between MISO and everybody else, there is. The significance of the wind is that that gives you one huge market. You can dump something in there and it disappears and you get money out of it. It's kind of neat. The other problem with it is that before you can do that, you got to get an interconnection, and you got to have somewhere where you're going to deliver it. So you need some kind of a market. South Dakota has a huge supply. Now they got to find where to put it, and when they find those two out, then we can make the design a transmission system to put the two ends together. This is the market, or the joint coordinated system plan and area, and we'll get most of the supply in the eastern United States with that, but we won't get all of the market potentials identified. But when we model it, we model the entire eastern interconnect, so we will have data on it, and we'll just have to make assumptions about the other areas. So the whole southeast is basically, we don't have good information about them. There's different types of markets. We have an energy market. That's where you just put energy in and they give you money back. And the ancillary service market, that means when you don't do what you're supposed to do, you got to buy it from somebody else, and you got to pay them for that. Ancillary services are your load following and all of that. And in the MISO market currently, wind isn't subject to charges for load following discrepancies and things. They can go into a spot market, bid their energy, deliver what they get, and they call it a price taker. You get what the price is from the market. And the price paid is always the highest cost generator on the system. So you get the highest cost of any generator. And the other one's a capacity market, and people were talking about the capacity versus energy. Capacity means, is it going to be there when I need it? And people, that has a value to it and a cost. MISO does not have a capacity market. What we have is reserve requirements. We have a certain amount of generation. If your load's so much, you have to have a certain coverage over that, like about 15%. And that's the way we do it. We just tell you, you got to have whatever you need plus a little more in case something fails. And how an energy market works, basically you just get paid the clearing price for the market. And MISO has a clearing price, PJM has a clearing price, and when you go across the borders, you're either in one or the other. This is not always have to be that way, but that's the way it is today. And if you want to see the prices for energy on the system, MISO has this on their website. You pull up the LMP contour map, you can see the prices all over MISO. You can see similar things for other ISOs in the United States. That red means it costs a lot, and the blue means it costs a little. And you see South Dakota wasn't doing so hot, but they weren't doing as bad as the other people that day. So. But you can see these color changes, like down here in this blue. And the reason for that is the transmission is constraining generation in a pocket, and it's not able to get to the higher cost areas. And those are the things that we work on to get rid of those. I covered that. Who has standards and who doesn't? You can see all the people that have standards. The Eastern Interconnect, the people that have standards but no wind, are over here on the East Coast. A renewable portfolio standard, something lawyers dreamed up and gave it to the engineers to administer. Basically, what it means is that you're required to have a certain amount of wind energy on your system, like 20% or 10%. And there's governors that went around in legislatures, that passed those, and they don't have any wind, so they're a little bit of a pickle of how they're going to do that. So they have something called green credits. So you could essentially sell it to them. So if you want to know where your markets are, it's where they don't have any wind, but they have a renewable portfolio standard. And here's who has wind and who doesn't have wind. You've seen that map. This is a map you haven't seen. That's the price of electricity across the United States. The blue is good and the red's bad. Unless you're selling, then the red's good and the blue's bad. And, of course, if you're selling, you'd like to take from the blue and sell to the red. Well, unfortunately, like I said, the transmission constraints right here, where the color changes, prevent that currently. And this is just a map that shows you the potential versus the load. The load's this little dinky thing down here, and this is your potential. Well, the thing is these are sources and these are sinks. So what you want to do is build transmission from the sources to the sinks. And we do that. This is one of our plans. This is from the MTEP 08 series. It's an HVDC plan up through the Minnesota area. I had it in North Dakota, but they moved it over there. The stakeholders moved it to Minnesota. They thought it looked nicer over there. And that goes all the way to New York and that high cost area. And it's in coordination with PJM. And if you put that plant on, that red area would turn to that color. And the way the market works is the money that they saved and your higher prices over there would be transferred back to the area that supplied the energy. So that's a benefit to the energy supplier. And the market already works that way. You don't need any new laws to do that. Okay, how much do you need to do that? If you wanted to do this out of South Dakota, you need about 15,000 megawatts. You need three lines, 5,000 megawatts apiece, and you need $15 billion. Well, that's a lot of money. But I already went through that. If you did that, you only need $20 a megawatt hour, basically, to pay for that transmission. That's the same as the production tax credit. If you give that, the money, the dollars per megawatt hour you would need to ship power from South Dakota to New Jersey at 15,000 megawatts of it, would be equivalent to $20 megawatt hour in today's dollars, and I won't get into that discussion. That's the same value as production tax credit. And it is also self-supportable by the market. The market difference is that much, according to our studies. Those studies, I told you, had a lot of information in them. That's why you should read them. And the other thing is this wind model that we're getting from NREL. For the first time, we're able to tell where the wind from South Dakota would compete with other wind. We have not had that data before. But if you have a, you have a 45% capacity factor in South Dakota, which would be a 100-meter tower, you could wipe out a 30% competitor anywhere between here and the East Coast and pay for the transmission. And the last thing, it'll take you more than 10 minutes to understand this, I require. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Terry Grove, a co-director of the CapEx initiative with Laura McCartan of Xcel Energy. And the other speakers have talked about high-level plans, and we've progressively moved down in detail. And you probably remember the way Dale started. He talked about the studies that would be done between the regional transmission areas, MISO to PJM and MISO to Southwest Power Pool. And Dale also talked about the regional studies, the MTEP 08 and 09 and beyond. What I'm going to talk about is the studies that are very specific to this area, and these are the studies that are used to define the facilities, to justify permitting them, and ultimately lead to construction. What I'm not going to talk about is the CapEx initiative, the projects we have underway, and some of our strategies. Other speakers during the conference will talk about those. A key study for CapEx, although certainly not the only one, is a study linked to the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard. And that's a standard codified in law in Minnesota. And one of the things it did was call out in great detail a study to be done. And that's to look at what it's going to take to deliver energy to meet the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard. It's not starting fresh, but it's to pull together a lot of things. It's highly collaborative with MISO, as is our other studies. And finally, as others have used the term, it's very open and transparent. There's a defined technical review committee that consists of members from all areas of interest in energy. Right on schedule, we delivered as required the first step of that. In November, we delivered a report on the Renewable Energy Standard, our first report. That, by the way, is on the MinElectrans website, if you have any interest in that. And it identified some very specific proposals. It identified critical issues, which others will talk about, in building transmission. And finally, it identified some very specific steps so that this doesn't remain an endless planning study. There are near-term milestones and longer-term milestones and a timeline for those. The Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard has very definite and binding goals in it for the utilities with load in Minnesota. In the blue block, you can see the requirement for Xcel Energy starting in 2010, 15% of their energy must come from renewable sources, graduating to 30% by 2020. For the other utilities doing business in Minnesota, it's 12% by 2012 and graduating to 25% by 2025. That is an energy standard, though. The total energy of that utility must meet that. To translate that into the amount of wind turbines, if wind is a renewable, that would have to be installed is not at all trivial. You have to make assumptions about where they are and their capacity factor. And if you're looking at the amount that's actually needed, you have to analyze the projects that are in the pipeline and expected to have transmission. And the planning folks did that. And what they've come up with is by 2010, while that's a very big number, that is a manageable number of 380 megawatts. For a 2012 milestone, 1,300 megawatts. And I should note, think of these as broad ranges, not these single point values here. Still manageable. By 2016, you need significant transmission infrastructure in place to meet the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard. Some of that is underway, and we'll talk about the CapEx Group 1 projects later, and some of that is projects yet to be planned, which is the subject of this. But more interestingly, if you look out to 2020 and 2025, those are huge numbers, even realizing the variation around them at 5,600 or 5,700 megawatts to meet just the Minnesota renewable energy requirement. Now, switching to the studies, these studies ultimately leading to building transmission, what this doesn't show for the sake of clarity is those higher level studies, the inter-RTO studies, the regional studies like MTEP by MISO, those would overarch all of this. At a parallel level to the Minnesota RES study, you have the Minnesota Biennial Plan, which is a required filing from all the utilities that integrates all the transmission projects to be built in Minnesota, large and small, load serving, these projects to deliver renewable energy. And then the renewable energy study itself is made up of several parts. They're all integrated within the renewable energy standard. And I'll highlight some of those. Consider the first top three, sort of a continuum, moving from things that have nearly an immediate need, and I'll explain that more in a minute, to those where we have some amount of time, not a great deal of time. If you go down to look at the third item, that the Minnesota Valley to Blue Lake study is shorthand for an existing 230 kilovolt system that runs from Granite Falls, Minnesota, to the Blue Lake substation, which is in the southwest suburban suburbs of the Twin Cities. And that is a facility that has been shown in studies to be fully loaded. Some of that loading is driven by just serving the load of customers, and a lot of it is driven by the existing wind on the Buffalo Ridge. The planners are going to undertake an immediate study to see if that should be upgraded. I would characterize them as very hopeful that study will show that an upgrade is justified. By justified, it has to perform well, it has to deliver a lot of energy, and a more vexing problem is they have to make sure that it'll play with future developments. If we start adding the kind of system Dale and others have described, it's got to be a building block that plays well with that kind of system. They're going to take that on immediately, and that will be done in probably by fall. And the CapEx utilities are already preparing that should that study bear out that project is indeed a good performer and justified, to move that forward to certificate of need in Minnesota as fast as we can. The 2016 study mentioned above it has some of the same characteristics. What the planners will be looking for there is projects with the same characteristics I described for Minnesota Valley Blue Lake. Does it help meet the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard? Is it flexible to accommodate a lot of different futures, including an eventual 765 type future? And they're going to look hard for other projects like that. By 2025, the top study, you're really looking for something else then. You're looking for regional energy supply, much akin to what Dale described. You're not just trying to meet a very aggressive Minnesota renewable energy requirement. You're trying to put in building blocks that could meet the renewable energy requirements of other states or even national energy requirements. There are two other studies that have a quite different purpose. The Generation and Transmission Optimization Study, the G&T study, is a special purpose, small geographic version of the study Dave described. It's going to look at the trade-off between placing wind to the west in the Dakotas versus the cost of the transmission to move it to the east. This is a complicated study, but we have some very good templates. This work's been done in California. It's been done in Texas, it's been done in Colorado, and we're going to pick up those templates and come up with a study that fits this region. A very near-term, fast-moving, and important study is the Distributed Generation Renewable Generation Study. This is a study actually led by the Minnesota Department of Commerce and required by legislation in Minnesota, and its purpose is to find spots on the transmission system where we could add smaller scale generation, say 10 to 40 megawatts, without driving a lot of transmission improvement. I believe all the participants are hopeful we can find those kind of locations. They're sort of a win-win for small-scale generation development. They can be done quickly. We just don't know the answer to that yet, but it's moving very fast. The initial sites will be proposed in December and initial results available in February. There's two repetitive phases of that. The goal is for each phase to find 600 megawatts of sites that have those characteristics. Don't know if that will occur, but we are working hard on that study. Dale had slides like this of the idea of producing a comprehensive conceptual plan, and this is another drawing and plan you can't take to the bank. This is an idea of a near-term future, not a 765 future, that concentrates on meeting the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard. And you can see there's long spokes sticking out from sort of the Metro Twin Cities area. Some of those are Group 1 CapEx projects. Others are like this idea for Min Valley to Blue Lake study. You can see the spokes are connected by sort of north to south lines. And that's the kind of blueprint the planners need to get before they can proceed into the longer-term improvements. And finally, we talked a lot about the studies, but talking about how the study timeline fits a broader timeline of constructing transmission, it's generally thought that to construct or plan, permit, and construct these large EHV facilities, you're generally talking of 7 to 8 years from the planning, first time the planning study is undertaken to the time the full facility is energized. And so if you look at the top horizontal bar, you can see with a 2016 Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard milestone that will require new transmission, it is still doable. If the studies are finished fast and they identify projects like Minnesota Valley, Blue Lake, and we can move forward very quick, and the regulatory processes and the other processes which the utilities have more control over, like engineering and construction, can move quick, the projects can be energized by 2016. If you move down one row, you have a little more breathing room as planners, and we don't want to use that up unnecessarily, but you have some time to integrate what I'd call the local vision in with the larger term regional and even national visions. But that is coming very quick. Those kind of projects may take more than 7 or 8 years, and they're also going to beg policy questions, which others I know are going to talk about, that may take some time to resolve. And so you can see the timeline of the studies, which we talked about on there. In summary, the CapEx utilities, along with the interconnected utilities around us and MISO and agencies like the Minnesota Department of Commerce, are moving very fast on the studies, and we need to in order to make the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard milestones alone, not to mention providing development opportunities and possibly supplying the region. We are moving ahead, and we need to. Thank you.
Let me just make a suggestion. Thank you for bearing with us. I know we're a little bit behind in schedule, and my suggestion is that we allow Bob go ahead. We take a couple questions, and then we take a full break, and we come back for more questions so that people can think and have some coffee along with it. Is that all right? You just want to go directly to the break? Okay, so we'll have Bob, and then we'll go to a break, and then we'll come back for questions.
Okay. Thank you. Which one does? Thank you very much. Otherwise, I saw by the schedule that I was already finished. It's an honor to be here as a representative of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy. I see there's a number of our tribes that have been here through the day and will be here tomorrow. And it's an honor to represent them and to present some perspective from the tribal point of view through the process of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, Intertribal COU, has been involved with. The transmission photograph in the bottom corner here is one of Western Area Power Administration's. I took off their website, and it's not by accident. Intertribal Council on Utility Policy formed in the Dakotas, tribes in North Dakota, South Dakota now, Nebraska, Iowa, and Wyoming, 13 tribes. And we're looking, grew out of the issues around the hydropower allocation process, where the tribes, who were always potentially preference customers for Western Area Power Administration power, were denied it by regulation because they weren't utilities. And in the process of securing those rights as part of their water rights on the Missouri River, the tribes went through an IRP process, looked at their renewable resources, and saw wind as a tremendous, tremendous resource. The blue dots on this map show you the reservations across the country and their wind potential. And the blue dots are so big in the northern plains, you can't even see the reservations underneath them. That gives you an idea of the potential that's there. And when we look at the installed wind capacity, depends upon wind resource transmission and policy, but policy trumps. If you look at this map, you see the greatest, well, go back here. Iowa is not one of the biggest wind resources in the country, neither is Minnesota. But we look at the number of resources installed, the number of turbines installed in places like that, it far outweighs those in the Dakotas. That's a policy reason, as well as transmission and how transmission is used. What's in the wind? Global wind power capacity is predicted to be more than triple by 2015 worldwide. Currently, GE is looking at building some or having some facilities built here in South Dakota. That gives us an idea of where wind is going, where the trends are leading. We look at the Dakotas, we look at Montana, and The Economist magazine in December of 2005 looked at it and said, "This is the new American ghetto. This is the poorest part of the country. Did you know that?" They also say you didn't know it either. Part of the issue is we're the poorest part statistically from around the country, but we're just not aware of it. We just don't know it. But the numbers are in, and the area does include a number of Indian reservations as wretched pockets of poverty. But they say the poverty is largely white. But when you look at the stats for personal income and unemployment rates, the darker the color, the worse the situation. And you see that the Indian reservations are coterminous with the worst of the unemployment and the poverty in this region. So coming from this perspective, what can wind bring to the most impoverished part of the country, and particularly for the tribes, some of the poorest communities in America? Part of the reason for that poverty, and this goes to where transmission comes from, 1890s, the idea was the Indians were vanishing Americans. They weren't going to be here. So in the 19th century, the 20th century, 1900s, we started legislation for planning and building infrastructure like transmission. Tribes were just not included in the thinking, in the whole process. When the build-out came in the 50s and 60s of the dams and then the transmission wires after that, tribes were still not included. Large WAPA transmission lines cross reservations. A lot of the right-of-ways were signed off by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and maybe later approved by the tribes. But the tribes weren't in that planning process at all, which is why by the 1980s, tribes couldn't even buy power off the wires that went over their heads. But by the 1985 to 2000, tribes became involved in the process. Tribes didn't disappear. They've become stronger, larger, politically more savvy, and are now, in the 21st century, are now being real players in the game and wannabe players, particularly in the next generation of energy build-out, which will be wind power. This is a traditional electric industry economy. Natural resources, coal, hydro, the jobs around construction, extraction, the generation, then control and operation and maintenance of the power lines, the system, transmission, distribution, the jobs involved in that, and then consumption. Use a lot of electricity. This is the traditional historic Indian electricity economy. A lot of natural resources and consuming a lot of power and selling those natural resources cheap or having them taken away. Flood control to a tribe. The dams were all built for flood control on the Missouri. And if you don't know where the reservations are, look for the dams and look upstream. Tribes got the reservoirs. They didn't get the dams. For flood control, tribes are permanently flooded, and someone else is in control. That's been the historic situation. And it's a recipe for poverty. Why, with all those great resources, are folks still poor? Because they haven't been able to fill in the value-added spots in between. We'd like to see tribes participate at every level, particularly with the new generation of wind power coming in and finding those jobs. This is for those, how many people believe in climate change? Okay, for the rest of you, this is the Dakotas 100 million years ago when our coal resources were formed. That's what the environment looked like when all that carbon was still in the atmosphere. We've taken it out, or the Earth took it out of the atmosphere with lots of plants, piled it up and left when the seas receded, a coal resource, lignite resource, in North Dakota particularly. So climate change has happened here already. It's happening every day. It's a statistical aggregation. And what looks like big oceans or seas, those beds are coal beds left over from the plants from those old seas. And we are now burning that and putting it back in the atmosphere at an unprecedented rate. That's where climate change comes from. We're putting that carbon back in the air. Our electricity, most of our electricity, comes from burning lignite, 85% now. And that's the most carbon-intensive electricity in the country. And from what we've heard already today, with the green tags and offsets, we could be paid to keep that in the ground. Now, there's an economy. Now, we've got to lead our fossil-based economy away from dinosaur dung and towards renewables. And we've got to do this worldwide. And we can do that right here at home. Tribes looking at climate change issues saw renewables as the answer. Locally, for tribal sovereignty, you want to have control over energy within your own boundaries, and globally it makes a difference. Tribes have the highest unemployment rates in the country, fastest growing population, and if you live on an Indian reservation, you're 10 times more likely not to have electricity at all than anywhere else in the country, and if you do have it, you pay a higher proportion of your household income for it. The first wind turbine, 100% tribally owned utility scale at Rosebud, it's the Little Soldier. It's down on the bottom. That's a long shadow that it's casting on Google Earth, and that turbine has cast a long shadow on policy and tribal aspirations for renewables. The new administrator from Western Area Power Administration, Tim Meeks, came on the job in January. He said, I've got three priorities, transmission, wind, and Native Americans, because it's a federal responsibility and because there were some directives written in the Energy Policy Act of 2005. We walked into his office and said, if this was a casino, you'd just hit the jackpot. Those same three markers come up for us, too. And why do they do that? Because the transmission system we have in the Dakotas is connected to the largest battery, hydro battery, in the world until Three Gorges was built. Tremendous opportunity to work wind and hydro together. And you can't quite see it from the back, I'm sure, but those blue dots are connected by red lines. And that's the Western Area Power Administration grid. This is the transmission system for the West. This is the federal Western transmission that was built as the backbone for all of the rest of that. In South Dakota, it comes off of our dams. Tribes working with our federal treaty partners look to see what we can do about building an energy dynamo using existing transmission and the surplus space, the capacity on it, because of the drought for the last 9 years that climate scientists tell us is the new normal for the next century, at least. who has put forth a plan starting with a number of reservations, single turbine projects, looking at a larger project that Rosebud is building, a 30 to 60 megawatt project, and using the learning, the understanding, the capacity we're building there to build out an intertribal project on 8 to 10, maybe all 13 reservations. Scattered across the upper Great Plains, it makes a whole lot more sense to feed in a little bit of wind from a lot of places than a lot of wind at one place. And we're working again, as I said, closely with WAPA to make this happen, looking at where wind can be put in, working with various studies. And if they work, we could look by 2015 to have 3,000 megawatts coming from Indian country, tribally owned, building those economies based on sustainable energy. We proposed this in 2001, 2002. It was a jaw-dropping number. Now we hear that that's 1% of the 20% energy goal could come from Indian country. Tribes can gain a lot of shared experience, share risk, build capacity, working together. There's a lot of great opportunities in that aggregation of tribal effort. And the plan that the Intertribal Coup Tribes put together received the World Clean Energy Award this year in Basel, Switzerland. And we're very appreciative of the world. It's the only one in the U.S. that was recognized. And renewable projects around the world were recognized, 9 of them. But this was one of them. Basically, it looks at how we can work within that system, tribes across the country. And we've got to do it. Federal policy's changing, world policy's changing. What used to be able to, the federal policies that help us build our coal plants now are going to be taxing coal. We've got to find ways to be able to monetize and participate in a new economy. All right, these slides sometimes come out, sometimes they don't. We'll go past that. As we saw here with Dave's presentation, there's things you've got to look at to get wind into the system, and tribes can do that. Tribes can do that in a manner that allows 2 megawatts of wind to stay, 2 megawatts of hydro to stay in the system, can support 50 to 100 megawatts of wind out connected to that system, because it helps to deal with meeting regulation. The on and off variations of wind coming on and off the system. A little bit of hydro left supports a lot of wind along the system. This is basically what I wanted to show, to see how transmission capacity needs to be utilized for renewables. As we look at hydro, once the whole region was served with 100% hydro. Today, we're closer to 85% coal, 15% hydro. And today, coal wags the dog. It uses hydro as a cheap peaker plant. We need this, and there's no room to fit wind. It's a business-as-usual business scenario. You can't get wind into that system. You've got to think of the capacity as open, how much wind can the system take, build that into the system, mix it with hydro, bring in then the coal, and also put incentives for IGCC. Because we've got a future. And how should our limited hydropower and constrained existing transmission be used best? To continue an economically depressed present, or to build and support a brighter, cleaner, greener future? We know these are the resource, these are the revenue streams that come from wind, electricity, sales, RECs or tags, the offsets, and the PTC. Tribes don't get the PTC. Because they're governments. So federal policy penalizes tribal equity in projects built on their own reservations. The Western governors have supported a shareable tax credit for entities like tribes. The National Congress of American Indians has supported the same concept, and there's currently a bill in the House, H.R. 1954, the year of Elvis Presley's first hit, It's All Right, Mama. I think he was talking about the earth. And Senator Tim Johnson's office now is looking at a companion piece in the Senate. The Renewable Portfolio Standard, that policy can bring revenue benefits to the tribes. Can build jobs and build a future. Fastest growing population in America is in Indian country. We need jobs. We need that support. Conclusions and recommendations. Western wind supplemental power priority. Wind should be given some priority onto the Western system. The Missouri River Tribal Federal Wind Hydro Demonstration Project should be funded. It's being in the study process right now, the idea of seeing how we can integrate wind and hydro on the system. And finally, the shareable PTC. Thank you very much.